There's no doubt about it, and now ACOG agrees. It really is the best screening test that we've ever had. This is a pretty expensive test without insurance. The hope is that now that ACOG is recommending this test for everyone, that insurance companies will get on board and it'll be accessible to a lot more women.
Welcome to Genotypecast, a new podcast from Gray Genetics. Genetics isn't always black and white. News stories related to genetics often raise more questions than they answer. On Genotypecast, we bring you insight from genetic counselors. I'm your host, Eleanor Griffith, a certified genetic counselor and the founder of Gray Genetics, an independent telehealth genetic counseling and consulting service.
Even though it's looking for the most common chromosome problems, in general, it's not looking at most of the chromosomes. And as the conditions are less validated and they're more rare, that positive predictive value can be quite low.
Emily Goldberg is a certified genetic counselor. She graduated with a Master's of Science in Human Genetics from Sarah Lawrence College in 2011 and has spent most of her career at Montefiore Medical Center, providing both prenatal and cancer genetic counseling. She recently started working full-time with J-Screen, a nonprofit organization offering at-home carrier screening and soon-to-be testing for hereditary cancer syndromes. Although she's normally in New York City, she's currently riding out the pandemic in Vermont with her two-year-old son and brand new baby boy. So Emily, thank you for talking with me about these new ACOG guidelines.
Thank you for having me. I've never done a podcast before, so exciting.
So this ACOG guideline, screening for fetal chromosomal abnormalities, it updates and replaces a 2016 guideline. And I think that the really significant change is that ACOG is now recommending NIPS or non-invasive prenatal screening for that be offered to women, any woman who's pregnant, not just high-risk women. Is that your understanding of the new guidelines?
Yes, that is correct. That it used to be only recommended for women who started off with a higher chance, either based on their age or an abnormal ultrasound or an abnormal screening test. And this new guideline basically says that it can be a first-line testing for all women, regardless of age or other risk factors.
And it's my impression that most centers have been offering this test to low-risk women for years. Is that your impression too?
I think if you're talking about New York City, that's true. The rest of the country where some of this testing may be a little bit less accessible, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But I do think that there are a lot of centers that have been offering this to everyone and other centers that have been sticking with other longer standing screening methods, especially when it comes to cost and availability in their specific demographic.
Yeah. And so insurance often follows guidelines, right? So the hope is that reimbursement for this test coverage will actually improve now.
Exactly. So this is a pretty expensive test without insurance. And oftentimes insurance guidelines or insurance coverage follows the guidelines that are out there. And a lot of insurances are not covering this type of testing for women who are low risk because it's not technically what's recommended. So the hope is that now that ACOG is recommending this test for everyone, that insurance companies will get on board and it'll be accessible to a lot more women.
Right. And so at your center, this test is only offered by genetics currently, right? Not by OBs. Do you think that'll change and be more widely offered by OBs, or do you think they'll still refer to genetics?
So I think it'll be a combination. I think there are lots of women who need to be referred to genetics for other reasons, and we're certainly happy to see them and also talk about NIPS versus prenatal diagnosis in those pregnancies. But I do think that as it gets easier to manage, especially with insurance and logistically, that the generalist OBs will also start to offer these regularly.
Anecdotally, I've heard at least a handful of stories of OBs talking to patients about positive results and acting on it as if it's a positive diagnostic result as opposed to a screening result. Mm-hmm. Have you experienced that, or maybe not at your center since the OBs aren't ordering this?
I think there are definitely those types of stories out there. This type of genetic testing, even though for us, we've been doing it for years and we understand the intricacies of it, it really can be complex in interpreting these results. So it is, there's no doubt about it. And now ACOG agrees. It really is the best screening test that we've ever had. It's really very good as a screening test. But at the end of the day, it is screening. It's not diagnosis. And there's a lot of different reasons why the test can be discordant. We don't necessarily say that it's wrong, but discordant, meaning that what the fetus has and what the results show can be different. And sometimes it's hard to counsel about exactly why it's different and help the patient understand that even though it's a really high risk, it doesn't mean it's 100%, especially depending on what it's actually positive for. And the same thing goes if it's negative, that it's really reassuring to get a normal test result, but we also have to, you know, correlate it with what we know about the patient based on their age and their ultrasound and their family history and, you know, what else we know about them. Because just because it's normal doesn't mean that fetus doesn't have a chromosome problem.
Right. Yeah. And this test is really accurate when it comes to the common aneuploidies like trisomy 21, but a lot of companies offer a version of this test that also screens for microdeletions and duplications. Can you talk a little bit about those options?
Sure. So as you said, for trisomy 21 or Down syndrome, this test is really very good. I've had very few occurrences where there's a discordant result when we're talking about Down syndrome, although it does happen. But some of these more rare chromosome problems, even trisomy 13 or differences with the X chromosome, and certainly with some of these microdeletions or duplications, because they're more rare, then you're sort of starting off with a lower chance of being positive in the first place. So one thing that we look at when we're interpreting a result is something called the positive predictive value, which basically means if you have an abnormal result, what is the chance that it's actually a true abnormal result? And as the conditions are less validated and they're more rare, that positive predictive value can be quite low. So there are lots of women who may have a test that includes one of these more rare conditions and it is abnormal, but still the biggest chance if they are doing a diagnostic test is that that test will come back normal. So it can be hard to interpret and to explain to a patient that it is something that we're concerned about. The only way to really know for sure is with diagnostic testing, either during the pregnancy or postnatally. So it's a high chance, but it definitely is not for sure.
And diagnostic testing would either be CVS or amniocentesis during pregnancy, right?
Yes. Or for people who are not comfortable with those types of procedures, we recommend following it up after birth.
And at your center, you're not offering, you don't routinely offer the screening that includes those microdeletions and duplications. Is that right?
That's true. As of now, both ACOG and ACMG, which is the American College of Medical Genetics, are not recommending those expanded panels just because a lot of them have not been validated and the positive predictive values are still low. So currently we're only offering it for the common trisomies, as well as sex chromosome abnormalities. And some of the panels actually include one of the more common microdeletions, which is the 22q11.2 deletion syndrome. That one often is included in the panel that we offer.
Okay. You always call out your results for NIPS, right? And with COVID, you're not seeing patients in person at all. But how does that usually work with calling out results as opposed to when they're positive specifically?
So anytime we're calling out abnormal results, we want to check in with the patient and make sure that it's a good time for them to talk or that they're somewhere quiet and safe. For example, we don't want to give somebody really difficult news when they're driving down the highway. Or they're at work and they're in the middle of a meeting about to give a big presentation. So we want to make sure that they're in a place where they can take a few minutes to hear their results, give them an opportunity to ask questions, and really feel that they're in a safe space. I often find that when I'm giving difficult results, that the initial conversation is pretty short, that patients don't really have questions yet. They're really still processing the information. And then they'll call me back an hour later with a list of questions and we can have a much more in-depth discussion. But I find that patients sort of need a few minutes to sit with it and process it before they can voice their concerns and questions about it.
Anything else you think we should cover specific to this guideline update or to NIPS more generally for people to understand?
I think one other thing that's important to remember is that even though it's looking for the most common chromosome problems, in general, it's not looking at most of the chromosomes, right? So we have 23 pairs of chromosomes, and most times when we're ordering NIPS, it's looking for trisomy 21, 13, and 18, the X and Y chromosomes, and sometimes other microdeletions like the 22q11.2 deletion. But it's important to remember that it's not picking up other chromosome problems. For example, if there's something running in the family that causes a piece of chromosome 16 to flip upside down, NIPS is not going to pick it up, not because it's a bad test, but because it's not designed to look for chromosome 16. So oftentimes when there's something specific in the family or we see something going on with a fetus's ultrasound, we may suggest that NIPS is not the best test because it's not looking for the particular thing we're worried about or because it can't test for as much and also could give some false reassurance.
Right. So especially if you're concerned about your family history, that's not going to be the most helpful test for you.
Right. So even for any patient who's low risk with nothing going on ultrasound or from their family history, if they do NIPS and they get a low risk result, of course that's reassuring, but there's still about a 2 to 3% chance that there's something that we would find with the genetics if we did a CVS or amniocentesis. So it basically lowers somebody's risk dramatically, but it can't test for everything.
And that 2 to 3% would include not only chromosome abnormalities, but also microdeletions and duplications that you pick up with a microarray if you're doing that test as well on the amniotic fluid sample. Is that right?
Yes, exactly.
Do you find that most patients who are having diagnostic testing done opt to have that additional analysis done, the microarray?
Yes, most of them are doing it now. It's sort of similar to when NIPS came out, when the microarray first came out, that we knew it could test for more and it was a really good test when you're already doing a procedure, but a lot of insurances were not covering it and it can be a few thousand dollars if it's not covered. Mm-hmm. But now most insurances, almost all of them, will cover the microarray if somebody's doing a procedure, especially if there's something high risk, for example, an abnormal ultrasound. So it's pretty standard now to at least offer it. And then if we need to check insurance ahead of time, we always do that too.
If you are a certified genetic counselor and would like to come on GenotypeCast to talk about an issue related to genetics in the news, send an email to podcast@graygenetics.com.
The information contained in this podcast does not constitute medical advice and is also not a substitute for genetic counseling. Neither Gray Genetics nor any of its guests makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the statements or any information contained in this podcast. Evaluation of an individual's personal and family health history is a crucial part of genetic counseling and any recommendations.